All right, Jewish marriage part 5. So we're in the middle of discussing who you're supposed to marry. That's what we were discussing yesterday. We started speaking about who you shouldn't marry, and then we're talking about who you should marry. So we'll finish up that discussion of who you should marry, and then we'll talk about some miscellaneous ideas that are related to Jewish marriage that we didn't have a chance to speak about at greater length.
No, I'll join
you. Oh, thank you. What's your name again?
Natan.
Okay, Natan.
How long is the show going to be?
What?
How long is it going to be? Like an hour?
He has to leave at 5.
That's 1:15 now.
Something like that. Okay.
Sorry, just real quick. I know we went over this, but the middle part, the forbidden relations that in Karis, that's... We're not talking about marriage in those cases. We're just talking about like the act of like having sex.
Right, because let's say the first one over there on that list was married woman, right? So you can't marry a married woman because she's married to somebody else already.
Can't
so if you do kedushin,
an
right? An can't marry an animal. Can't yeah. A man can't marry a man. Just doesn't the kedushin doesn't work at all. Right?
Not according to American society.
American society doesn't recognize kedushin. Okay, so here's the question. So you want to marry a girl, yeah? And your father opposes the marriage. He doesn't want you to marry her, right? So on the one hand, one of the Ten Commandments, right? The fifth of the Ten Commandments is honor thy father and thy mother. So you have to respect your parents. You know, respect their opinion. Try to listen to what they say. And on the other hand, you like this girl and you really want to marry her. So are you obligated to call it off in deference to your parents' opinion?
Actually, the question applies to me.
So the Ramah in Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah in brings down in the name of the Marik, Rav Yosef Kolon, who says that the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Em, the commandment of honoring your parents, does not apply in this situation. Because they don't have the right to tell you who to or who not to marry. So it doesn't apply. So there's like some other different ideas over here about who you should marry, who not to marry. This is Gemara in the Maseches Pesachim on page 49a and b, and the Gemara talks about how a regular Jew, if he marries the daughter of a Kohen, ain zivugan ola yafa, the match is not going to work out so well. It's not going to come out so well. A bas Kohen li Israel, ain zivugan ola yafa. That's what the Gemara says. But then the Gemara sort of qualifies this and says that that's only talking about if the Yisrael is an Am Haaretz. He's a commoner, an ignoramus, just a regular person. But if he's a Talmid Chacham, so then it does work out good. And then from that, the Gemara segues into a whole discussion about, you know, the difference between an Am Haaretz and a Talmid Chacham when it comes to marriage. So the Gemara says like this. I'll just like read a few of the lines. The Gemara says, Tanu Rabbanan, a person should always sell everything that he has in order to have the money to marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham. Why? Because if he would die, or he would have to be sent into exile and leave the country and leave his family behind, he's guaranteed, so to speak, that his children will be Talmid Chacham. Because his wife is a Talmid Chacham, so she knows how to raise Talmid Chacham. She was in a family of Talmid Chachamim. And maybe because if he leaves, so then the father figure will be like the grandfather, who's a Talmid Chacham. She'll bring him to her parents, and then the children will also become a Talmid Chacham. But do not marry the daughter of an ignoramus. She makes a gaila, bun of Amaratim. Because if he will die or he will go into exile, then his children will be left as Amaratim. They'll be left as ignoramuses.
Wow.
Gemara continues, it says, Tanu Rabbanan, La'alam yimkor adam koma shiyeshlai v'yisa basal chacham. A person should always sell everything that he has in order to marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham, v'yasi bita le Talmid Chacham, and to marry his daughter to a Talmid Chacham. So not only should you marry the daughter of a Talmid Chacham, but you should also make sure that your daughter marries a Talmid Chacham. That's what the Gemara says. V'lo yisa bas am aretz, and you shouldn't marry the daughter of an am aretz, etc.
No matter who you are, you should
never marry. Doesn't say you shouldn't. No matter who you are, each person according to, you know, his level. Some people say that we don't have what the Gemara calls an am aretz. We don't have that nowadays. It's a certain level of opposition to religion, to Torah. like a Jew who sort of.
It's chutz v'shalom that I'm cholekin the Gemara, but how do we not have that as people who don't know shas? They don't never learn Gemara in their life. They never learn halacha in their life.
Right.
So there
could be that there's a, when the Gemara talks about Amaretz, it's not just somebody who doesn't know things, but it's somebody who's sort of like he doesn't know and he's also anti.
Oh,
the Gemara later in this topic, the Gemara says, the Gemara says about Rabbi Kiva, you know, the famous Rabbi Kiva who started studying when he became 40 years old. So Rabbi Kiva says, "Kishayisi Amaretz, when I used to be an Amaretz, Amarti, I used to say, Mi iten li Talmud Chacham v'anashechenu kachamar." He said, "Who's going to bring me a Talmud Chacham that I could bite him like a donkey bites somebody?" It's like there's some sort of animosity between the Amaretz and the Talmud Chacham. It's not just that he doesn't know anything; it's that he doesn't know anything, and he's also anti the Talmud Chacham.
Oh, saying good.
Right. And then also we said yesterday that yesterday we were discussing, the Gemara says that you're supposed to look at a woman's brothers in order to see if she's suitable for marriage. So we said in the name of Yaakov Kamenetsky that could be that this doesn't apply nowadays, because it used to be that girls would grow up in their family and they wouldn't really leave outside, you know, they wouldn't really leave their home, they didn't go to school, right? They didn't really work. So they, you know, their whole influence, their whole world view is formed based on their father, their brothers, etc. Right? So it could be that nowadays women are more broad, they go to school, they're outside in the world like everyone else is. So then it could be that the daughter of an Amoraites is not as bad as it once was. She has broader horizons than a person.
I want to be medayek. I want to say, but since it could be the opposite way, if her brothers are Tamidei Chachamim or her brothers are well learned in Torah, besides because she is influenced by the outside society, it doesn't mean that she's.
That could be also. That's also true.
Wow.
It could be it works both ways. So I think Gemara says another interesting point. This is actually brought down in the Shulchan Aruch as well. It says, Tan Rabbanan, Lo'ala Mimka Adam Kom HaShi'esh Le'Viyisa Bas Tamal Chacham. A person should always sell whatever he has in order to marry the daughter of a Tamal Chacham. V'Lo'i Matza Bas Tamal Chacham. If you didn't find the daughter of a Tamal Chacham, Yisa Bas Gedalia Dor. You should marry the daughter of the Gedalia Dor. So the Gedalia Dor in the Gemara doesn't mean what we colloquially call Gedalia Dor. No, it doesn't mean what we call colloquially Gedalia Dor, like the most important Talmid Chacham of the generation.
What does it mean?
Rashi says, what's Gedalia Dor? Anshe Maisa V'Tzadikim. Righteous people, people that do good deeds, that's Gedalia Dor.
Tzadikim, right? Is a very high level.
Yeah. Loi Matzah Bas Gedalia Talmud Chacham is a higher level, then the next level is Gedalia Dor. Loi Matzah Bas Gedalia Dor, if you could find someone who's a daughter of a Gedalia Dor, Yisa Bas Reshe Knasiyos. You should marry somebody who's the daughter of a Reshe Knasiyos. I understand that to mean like a communal leader.
Yeah, like
a lay leader, maybe an Askan, right? Some sort of, you know, a person who has some sort of political role.
Like the daughter of the Rosh Hashiva.
Depends on what type of Rosh Hashiva he is. Some Rosh Hashivas are Talmid Chachamim, some Rosh Hashivas are over-glorified fundraisers. It depends on the situation.
Sorry, what type of boy are we talking about?
Well, that's another question. Each person, you have to know, you know, according to his level. Loi Matzah Bas Reshe Knesiyos. If you couldn't, we're just going in order of like what's most optimal. In the best situation. Loi Matzah Bas Reshe Knesiyos. If you couldn't find the daughter of a guy who's a communal leader, Yisa Bas Gabei Tztaka. You should marry the daughter of a guy who's a Gabei Tztaka, a person who's a treasurer of a charitable fund. So usually Rashi says that usually they only appoint a treasurer of a charitable fund, a person who's a good person, someone who's trustworthy, reliable. That's the type of person that they appoint. So in this type of situation, so you should marry that guy's daughter. Loi Matzah Bas Gabei Tztaka. If you couldn't find the daughter of a Gabei Tztaka, of a charitable treasurer, so Yisa Bas Melamde Tinaikis. You should marry the daughter of a Melamde Tinaikis, of a, you know, of an elementary school Rebbe, basically. He doesn't have to be a Talmud Chacham, he's not level of a Talmud Chacham, but he is somebody who has an honorable profession. You know, V'lo Yisa Bas Amei Haaretz. But you should not marry the daughter of an Amei Haaretz. Again, B'pnei She'ein Sheketz V'nei She'ein Sheretz. Gemara says some very harif, very sharp words against the Amei Haaretz, that the daughter of an Amei Haaretz is a Sheketz, so it's like a abomination, and their wives are like a Sheretz, like a, what's it called? Like a creepy crawly animal, like an insect. The Gemara says some very, very sharp, harif words over here.
He's talking somebody about somebody who doesn't know the Torah or something.
Amaretz?
Yeah.
So he said, but we were just saying that Amaretz, it sounds like it's not just a person who's ignorant, he has a lack of knowledge, but he also has some sort of animosity. He's like anti.
Sounds like we're talking more about the parents.
Right, I think it was before you came. We made that point that it could be that now it used to be that it was just the parents really that formed the woman's, a girl's world view of the world, right? And so if you look at the parents, you basically know how she's going to turn out. But it could be that nowadays that girls have a more broader horizons. They go to school, they're outside in the world more than they used to be. So it could be that what their father is or does is not telling of who she is. And then it has no bearing on the topic at all. It could. The Gemara says another thing about a Talmud Chacham, about why you should marry your daughter to a Talmud Chacham. The Gemara says, "Kol amatzi biter la'am ha'aretz kilu kovso manicha lefnei ari." Anyone who marries his daughter to an Am Ha'aretz, it's as if he tied her down and left her in front of a lion.
Wow.
What
does
an Am Ha'aretz mean?
What?
What does an Am
Ha'aretz mean? So we were discussing that in the last like 15 minutes.
It says page 49, right?
49b.
Aye.
It's as if you tied her down and you left her in front of a lion. Why is that? The Gemara says, Ma'ari dereso eichel, just like a lion, it's so it claws at its prey and then it eats it. Ve'enlo bushes upon him and it's not embarrassed of doing so. Af am ha'aretz, so to an ignoramus, Maka, he hits his wife, Ubayel, and then he has intercourse with her. Ve'enlo bushes upon him. And he's not embarrassed of doing such a thing. Right, so there's sort of two ways you could look at this Gemara. Either the Gemara is saying that you know he would hit her and you know, they would have fight and they would have fight and then he would pressure they would be fighting between each other and then he would sort of pressure her to have relations with her without making up beforehand, right? So that's very bad. You know, you have to have when you're trying to be together, you have to have two minds that are set together. They have similar goals and they have this consent. Of they're going in the same place, but if they're fighting, it's not that's not meaningful relationship. That's one way of looking at it. He would actually fight with her, and the other is simply that he just doesn't give her enough time to be in the mood or to be ready for having a physical intimacy. So if a guy doesn't wait for her, if you don't wait for her, so then you're just like like a lion who just goes and you go, you claw away, you eat your stuff, and you do your thing without paying attention to that there's another person over here, right? So that's what the Gemara says about an Am Ha'aretz. But a Talmud Chacham, you can expect a Talmud Chacham to be more, more in control of himself and to be more open to that nuance. A Talmud Chacham is used to taking things slowly and patiently to work through a sugya, to work through a Talmudic topic, to try to get things from every angle and try to make sure everything works out.
Pretty interesting. Right? I don't see what A has to do with Z. Like, what is being a Talmud Chacham have to be with being just like an animal?
So that's what I'm saying.
The
Talmud Chacham, you can assume, has more patience and he's willing to work through things more so than the Am Ha'aretz, who just wants, like, he sees what he wants and he goes and grabs it.
And saying, I see, you see people who don't know much about Torah, they learn a little bit every day or whatever, they're not Talmud Chacham, and they have basic humanity, basic kindness, basic goodness, good people, and you see people that learn 12 hours a day and they're animals. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's true. The Gemara says about learning Torah.
What does it have to do with Z?
You're right. I mean, the Gemara says about learning Torah that Torah is the study of Torah is sort of compared to water, right? So water has the ability to make things grow. Well, it depends what you're growing. If you're growing, nice flat plants, flowers, vegetables, fruits, right? So then the water helps grow plants, flowers, vegetables, fruits, right? But if you're growing thorns, so the water is going to help the thorns to grow. Right? The Chazal say that Derech Eretz Kodmo LaTorah, the way of the land is a prerequisite to Torah. Reishis Chachma Yiras Hashem. Before you can get to the level of Chachma, you need Yiras Hashem. So you're absolutely right. A real Talmud Chacham, the basis is being a nice guy and everything before you start becoming a Talmud Chacham.
Yeah, but the only way he'll become a Talmid Chacham is if he learns. He can't become a Talmid Chacham if he doesn't learn.
Yeah, but who is...
And he can never have good midot if he doesn't learn. You could think that he has good midot, but he doesn't really.
But the
Gemara
says that it says, Yiras Hashem Yaitzorei. Yiras Hashem is the storage house. And then when you learn, so you put things into the storage house. If you don't have the storage house, you can learn and learn and learn. And where's it going? It's not going anywhere.
But how do you get the storage house in the first place? By learning how to get to the storage house. How do you get it? Right?
Okay, could be. I'm saying we're talking about two different things, but yeah. This thing of...
Which
is this? This is Psachim Mem Tesem Advez, 49b. This thing about the guy who he beats his wife and then he has relations with her. So it's an interesting question. Are you allowed to beat your wife or not? What do you say, Joe?
What kind of question is that?
So,
hey, you're allowed to beat your wife.
So people
you probably shouldn't say it here if there's cops around here.
People say that the Rambam says that a man is allowed to beat his wife. People bring that from the Rambam, and the Rambam does imply such a thing. The Ramah and the Marshal, two of the great Ashkenazi leaders, the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, and the Marshal, Rav Shlomo Luria, they write very strongly against this, and they say that, no, you're not allowed to beat your wife.
How does it even a Hava mean to beat your wife?
What?
How does it even a Hava mean to beat your wife?
I don't know. 1 second, we'll talk about it. But the Ramah...
No, I'm very confused.
No, you're right. There is no Hava Mina.
What's
Hava Mina? Hava
Mina... Is there even a thought? Like
how can it even enter your mind to think such a thing?
How could one rabbi
right?
even say to be your
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Which rabbi says this? I have to know never to listen to this. Yeah.
People say that the Rambam says that you're allowed to do that. But the Ramah and the Marshal... Sure, people do say a lot of things. The Ramah and the Marshal say that it's absolutely 100% forbidden. And could be, if there is such an implication in the Rambam, what the Rambam is talking about is that there's a general halacha that you're allowed to use physical force to stop a person from doing an avera.
So
right?
Why is that behind?
So that's what he's talking about.
So how do you explain that by beating your wife?
No, I didn't say that's what I'm saying. He didn't say you're allowed to just go around and beat your wife.
So who was medayik from that you could beat your wife?
There's people that say that.
Who are those people?
It's always the ubiquitous, you know, the anonymous, the people, the them. It's not us. We don't say it, but there are people that say it out there.
I don't know. I don't take it that as an answer. Like, oh, people say it. I want to know who said it.
Okay, I'll tell you this much. You're not gonna go to a Beit Spanish and find a source that brings down about this Rambam that you're allowed to beat your wife. You're not gonna find people that say it like that.
He doesn't say it explicitly. That how you know it'll be
right, exactly
assumed it.
So at least by the Ashkenazim, the minig is, or the halacha is, that you don't beat your wife, and it's usher to beat your wife.
Baruch Hashem.
The joke is, I
definitely hope that you can.
Right. So the question is it halachically justified? They might point to the Rambam and say that, but is that what the Rambam is talking about at all? Anyways.
I don't know, the way I see it is...
The joke is that by the Ashkenazim, the wife actually beats the husband. That's the joke. But, see, the truth is, the Gemara actually sort of talks about this. The Gemara says, when it's talking about Adam Rishon, when Hashem first created Adam Rishon, so he says, Esolei Ezer Kenegdoi. I'm going to create an Ezer Kenegdoi, a helper opposite him, or corresponding to him. Ezer and Kenegdoi. So the Gemara says, we need Azer or Kenegdoi. Is woman supposed to be a man's helper, or is it supposed to be a man's opposition? Kenegdoi or Azer? Azer means to help. Kenegdoi means opposition. So which one is it? So the Gemara says two answers. The Gemara says, well, either you could say Zocha Azer loy Zocha Kenegdoi. If he's Zocha, if he merits to have a proper marriage, so then she's going to be an Ezer, a helper to him. Loi Zacha, if he's not going to merit to have a good marriage, so then Kenegdai, she's going to oppose him. Right, that's one opinion in the Gemara. It's an interesting thing. The Gemara says, you have to have a special merit to have a good marriage. By default, it doesn't necessarily work out. You have to have Zacha, Ezer. Loi Zacha, Kenegdai.
Yeah, it's not that common where you see people that have good, let's be real, it's not...
Okay. Could be.
It's not that common where you see people that have like smooth marriages.
Could be. The second opinion of the Gemara says, Zocha Ezer, if you have a good merit, so then she'll be your helper. Loi Zocha Minagdai, it's sort of a play on words. Minagdai means she's going to whip him. So there you see this idea in the Gemara already, that the woman whips the man. Right? Minagdai is a play on words of Kenegdai. Obviously the Gemara doesn't literally mean it, but it means that she's going to be sort of his downfall. She's going to like whip him, meaning she's going to cause his downfall. Well, these are some different ideas about who to marry and some basic things about marriage. There's a few another topic, sort of, is Rabbi Yudah Chassid. Rabbi Yudah Chassid was from the group of Hasidei Ashkenaz. He lived in the 1100s in Germany, and the Hasidei Ashkenaz are known as the German Pietists. And Rabbi Yudah Chassid has some very interesting restrictions and ideas that he puts on who you can marry, what type of people should marry each other. So Rabbi Yudah Chassid, in his ethical will, known as Tzavas Rabbi Yudah Chassid, the command of Rabbi Yudah Chassid, his ethical will, so he writes some interesting ideas. So we'll just talk about a few of them. One of them is that he writes that if the woman's name, if a girl's name is equal to your mother's name, is the same name, right? Or if the girl's father's name is the same as your name, so you shouldn't marry her, right?
Equal, his father's name. Let's say his father's name is the same as my name, or
yeah,
right. Yeah. There's a girl, right? Her father's name is Reuven, and your name is Reuven, so you shouldn't marry such a girl. Or if you have a girl who her mother's name is, I don't know. Or her name is Yocheved, and your mother's name is Yocheved, so you shouldn't marry her.
Is that right? Halacha?
So this is what Rabbi Yudah Chassid says. So the question is, you know, how seriously do we have to take Rabbi Yudah Chassid's ethical will? Is it binding lahalacha? Is it like a Kabbalistic thing? Is it something that we have to look out for? Is there any room to be lenient? So the commentators, they take it seriously. The Pesachim do take it seriously, but they also try to find leniencies as much as possible. So like one of the leniencies is like you can sort of change your name. You know, if your name is not Reuven Shimon, but let's say Reuven Shimon, so you can like instead of going by Reuven and his name is Reuven, so you go by Reuven Shimon or just go by Shimon, and then even though you technically may have like part of your name is the same, it's still okay. Or you can change your name at all. You know, if your name is Reuven, so I change my name now to Chaim. Right? See, he doesn't say what his reason is, and you would assume that his reason is something that's Kabbalistic. He doesn't exactly explain, but you know, in general, Rabbi Yudah Chassid's writings are like, you know, delve into Kabbalah. Another heter that they say is that if you live in the separate cities, so then it's not a problem. So that would seem to suggest that the problem is more like Ayin Hara, they have two people in the same family with the same name. Something like that. Ayin Hara is the evil eye.
Right.
Like people will be jealous, and when people are jealous, so that could sort of arouse different heavenly accusations against the person. Bar Minan, as the Sfaradim say. A third heter they say is that if one of them is dead, so then it's okay. So like if the girl's mother is dead, if the girl's, or let's say if a person's mother is dead, right, so then he's allowed to marry a girl that's the same name as his mother, because then it's not like there's a conflict because she's not alive. Another heter that says if he's a Talmud Chacham, so then you could still do the marriage. Another heter that says if he's older than 20, so then it's more urgent that he get married, and you don't have to be particular about these type of things. And another heter is that this whole thing only applies to a first marriage. But if, let's say, a second marriage or any subsequent marriages, so then this Rabbi Yudah Chassid doesn't necessarily apply. These are different heterim that they want to, you know, they take it seriously, but you know, if you try to find a little bit of leeway, so you take the leeway. Some other Kabbalistic swarm will deal with a similar question. What do you do if the Chassid and the Kala have the same name? Is that a problem or not? The Chassid and the Kala have the same.
It's, yeah, crazy.
We have these like unit.
You have
unisexual bathrooms and you have unisexual names,
oh,
right? So you have like the name Yonah, right? So the name Yonah could be a man or it could be a girl. Or if you have the name Simcha, it could be a guy or it could be a girl, right? So could a guy named Simcha marry a girl named Simcha or not? Or a guy named Yonah marry a girl named Yonah?
So interesting.
So the Kabbalists say that you're not supposed to do that. But that, let's say if the guy's name is equal to his mother-in-law's name, he's Yonah, and his prospective mother-in-law is also Yonah, so they say that that's not such a problem. This brought my Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Lerner, in his Sefer Shmir Sigul Fanefesh, he says that halacha. So Rabbi Yehuda Chassid also brings down different things, different types of people that are not supposed to get married. He says, you shouldn't have two families that marry into each other twice. So like two brothers marrying two sisters, or a sister and a brother marrying a brother and a sister. He says that you're not supposed to do that. And I know definitely that people are not so particular about that. People actually do that nowadays.
Is that halacha or not?
It's not. This is not brought down in Shulchan Aruch. But these are things that people, it's sort of like folk halacha in a way. But it's like things that people are particular about because of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. What?
People do marry sisters.
Two brothers marrying two sisters?
Yeah.
I know cases of such things. Or,
are they successful?
Or two brothers marrying a woman and her daughter.
Wow.
Right?
That's
okay. He said, he says the same thing about two brothers marrying two sisters, or two brothers marrying a woman and their daughter, which according to halacha is okay. But Rabbi Yehuda Chassid says, you should be particular not to make such a match.
Maybe in a way you should just move to a different city, and then maybe it will be okay.
That could be.
Interesting.
He actually says that two married brothers shouldn't live in the same city. Rabbi Yehuda Chassid.
Two married brothers.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
Two brothers who happen to be married, they have their own separate families, and they're married or whatever, they shouldn't live in the same city.
Interesting.
So I don't know where he's coming from. These are like Kabbalistic ideas. It's not clear exactly why or what's the reason. Another thing Rabbi Yehuda Chassid says is that a man should not marry his brother or his sister's daughter, meaning his niece. A man should not marry his niece. Now that is somewhat problematic because the Gemara says that it's actually commendable to marry your niece. This sort of taking responsibility for the family. Well, according to Allah, it's for sure permitted to marry your niece, right? We have this chart that we gave out a few days ago. If we look at the chart, it doesn't say anywhere about marrying your niece, right? And the Gemara says that it's a positive thing to marry your niece. And then Rabbi Yehuda Chassid comes along and says, don't do it, that it's forbidden. So the question is like, why does Rabbi Yehuda Chassid say it's forbidden if the Gemara says it's okay? And this is a question that has bothered people for hundreds of years. Some people want to say that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid had some sort of prophetic advanced knowledge of genetics, and he saw that marrying your niece is not so good from a genetic perspective, that it could cause different issues and diseases. Some people want to say that that's what Rabbi Yehuda Chassid meant.
I think that's a good answer.
The Neid of Yehuda, he writes that he wants to bring a proof from this, that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid's ethical will wasn't said for everybody, because if it was said for everybody, how could he contradict the Gemara, which says that marrying your niece is commendable? And he's saying don't do it. He's arguing with the Gemara. So the Neid of Yehuda says that Rabbi Yehuda Chassid only meant that his descendants shouldn't do these things, but that everyone else, you're allowed to. So some people say, okay, if you're not a descendant, if you don't know that you're a descendant of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, so then it's okay. I happen to that I'm a descendant of Rabbi Yehuda Chassid. But most people don't, most people aren't into genealogy, and people that are into genealogy aren't so successful in finding their genealogical roots.
How do you know?
What?
How do you know specifically?
I've been doing genealogical research about my family for something like, for many years, let's say.
My rabbi has a list. He has the tree of life as a chassid, and he's related all the way. He has the tree of life all the way to Mordechai Tzadik.
Mordechai Tzadik.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was like, wow. When I saw it, I was like,
psh. And you are related to this guy?
Yeah. Actually, I wrote a whole essay about marrying. What?
How many years ago was he?
I said in the 1200s.
Well, makes it easier if your ancestors did their genealogy, so you just connect yourself.
Very good. So I actually wrote a whole paper about this idea of marrying your niece. It's called Avunculate Marriage in the Bible. It was published on Sfarim blog a few years ago. So if you want, look it up on Google. Avunculate Marriage in the Bible. I wrote this down in my notes. AVUNCULATE.
Okay.
So avunculate marriage is a fancy way of saying marrying your niece. Avunculate marriage in the Bible. So that's my essay about that topic.
Interesting. Wow.
Okay, so now we're going to talk about some miscellaneous things that are related to marriage, not necessarily about who to marry and who not to marry, but just like some general ideas. We're going to talk about the mitzvah of the halacha of ksuba, which is a marriage document. We'll go to the basics of what a ksuba is. We're going to talk about cherem derabinu gershom. We'll talk about what that is exactly. We'll talk about the mitzvah of yibum and chalitza. And then hopefully we'll give a big overview of, a general overview of the concept of nida, of the menstruating woman who's forbidden to her husband. And then maybe we'll answer Joe's question in the end about why only a mother. I don't think we're going to get there though. But, sorry Joe. No, not Joe. It wasn't your question. It was Alex's question, right? Somebody asked it a few days ago. Okay, fine. So forget about it. It was your question? No. It was Alex. You're sitting in Alex's seat. So we'll say that it was your question.
My question.
Okay. So, ksuba. The marriage document, there's halacha. The rabbis put in this halacha, established a halacha called a ksuba, which is a marriage document. The marriage document is there to protect the woman in case she gets divorced or her husband dies, so she's going to have some sort of financial backing. That's the main reason for the ksuba. It's there to protect the woman. It's also there, the rabbis, it's not clear exactly if the idea of ksuba is rabbinic in origin or it's biblical in origin, but the idea of ksuba is also there to make it that marriage is a serious thing. And that there are sort of financial penalties to a man if he wants to abolish or break down the marriage. He wants to divorce her, so then he has to pay up. You can't just divorce her, you know, offhand and then don't worry about it. Because then people are just going to marry and divorce like crazy, right? But there, if there's some sort of responsibility, you're taking responsibility. If I divorce you, so then I will give you a certain amount of money, I'll sustain you in certain cases, so then it'll make it a more serious commitment. The Gemara says that, the Shulchan Aruch says that it's forbidden for a man to be secluded with his wife. It's forbidden for him to do yichud with his own wife if they don't have a ksuba. Wow. So the ksuba is a very important protection for the woman.
Oh,
the Ramah, he disagrees with the Shulchan Aruch. The Ramah says, no, it's not forbidden to have yichud. Yichud is okay. You're allowed to be secluded, but you're just not allowed to have intimacy. You're not allowed to have intimate relations with her unless you have a ksuba. So this ksuba is this way of the rabbis protected the women who get married. If I could offer a little bit of a critique on the social concept of feminism, because from a feminist perspective, so this whole thing of ksuba is like offensive, because first of all, you're suggesting that women need protection, right? Yeah. So like, why do women need protection, right? So it's a very funny thing from a feminist perspective, because on the one hand, they'll criticize you for protecting the women, because by protecting them, you're implying that they need protection and they're more vulnerable than men, let's say, right? But on the other hand, if you don't protect them, then they're going to complain that you're not protecting them, right? So sort of the hypocrisy of modern day feminism. Think about that.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Where the woman herself takes the ksuba and tears it into pieces.
Yeah.
Have you done such a case?
No, I don't.
How would you judge such a case?
You're saying because by ripping it, she's being mochel? Is that what you're trying to ask?
The fact is that she took the ksuba
and she ripped it?
Not so smart.
Right? And so what's your question? Your question is, does that mean that she's foregoing her protection and that she's, you know, she's, let's go, she's being mochel, she's forgiving it? Yeah, I don't know. I hear it. It's a good question.
And the second question is about ichud with her.
Yeah.
And living with her.
What about it?
She's horrible.
Yeah.
There's no ksuba anymore and she's.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure what the halacha would be in that situation.
She rips the ksuba. Now
I think
divorce,
it's a,
no money.
From what I understand, right? I'm not sure if that's true. From what I understand, it's a blanket prohibition. It doesn't matter if she says, you know, I'm mochel, you know, I forgive, I waive my right to have this protection. I don't know if she has the right to do that. It sounds like it's a blanket rule. You have to have a ksuba in order to have a marriage.
And Another reason why she could do it is because she got mad at her husband.
Yeah.
And as a result, mad at her husband, she...
Yeah, I hear.
That could be another...
Why she got mad at her husband?
Population why she ripped the consumer.
Yeah, I don't know.
And I think it's like if somebody goes to the store and they get a receipt and they rip up the receipt, they stole...
You're saying the obligation is still there. You can't prove it.
Right.
Yeah, you just lost the proof.
Yeah, but in some stores, they say no refunds if you don't have the receipt.
Yeah.
I'm giving an example.
Okay, so what is the ksuba? So the ksuba says the essential part of the ksuba, the main part of the ksuba is that it says that if he dies or he divorces this lady, so then he or his estate will pay her either 100 or 200 zuz. Zuz was a currency that was used in ancient Israel. Either 100 or 200 zuz, depending on if she was a virgin when they got married or not. Right? So if she was a virgin, it's 200 zuz, because she's making a greater commitment to him. So he has to show more responsibility and offer more, pledge more money in this case. And if she wasn't a virgin, so then he's only 100 zuz. Of course, you can add as much as you want to the document, but this is the base. This is the minimum.
She's worth double.
Right.
She's a virgin.
This is the minimum.
Wow.
Okay. So when you sign the ksuba, you sign the ksuba, it's not just this stipulation, but there's other things that are involved in the ksuba as well. The first three are according to are mitzvahs of the Torah. So when a man signs the ksuba, he's obligating himself in three things. The first is mizonos; he's going to pay for her food. Right. The second is ona; he's going to take responsibility for her, let's say, physical pleasure, for making sure that he fulfills his conjugal obligations. Understood?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was pretty clear.
Number three is. Number two, is he's going to pay for her clothing. So food, clothing, and relations. Number four is this ikar ksuba, what we just talked about, the 100 to 200 zuz. Number five is he obligates himself to pay for her medical bills, should that be necessary. Number six is that he obligates himself to pay a ransom in case she gets kidnapped. Right? I'm saying this in a very general way, but each of these things is at least one siman in the Shulchan Aruch with a lot of details. It's like, how much does he have to pay? If they ask for an exorbitant amount of money, are you allowed to pay? Are you not allowed to pay? Right? Because if you pay an exorbitant amount of money for ransom, so all that does is it encourages pirates or kidnappers to kidnap more people because they see they can make a lot of money from it.
That's your wife. You have a soft spot for her.
Right. So if it was yourself, so then of course you're allowed to pay an exorbitant amount of money. Do we say that your wife is like yourself, or do we say that your wife is like you're helping redeem somebody else? It's a question. It's a question of halacha. Number seven is you obligate yourself to take responsibility for her burial. So you have to like buy her cemetery plot and buy a tombstone and everything.
Which wife do you, does the husband
get buried next to?
Closer.
I don't know.
He ends up having two wives.
I don't know.
I'm talking about the case of Rabbi Vera Wine.
I don't know. You can ask him. Number eight is you obligate yourself to pay for her sustenance if she becomes a widow for as long as she is a widow. Meaning, unless she gets remarried, you know, she would be paid from his estate. Forever or until she dies. Number nine is you obligate yourself to pay for her daughters that they should.
You should. Man,
that you're gonna. So then, obviously, you can't pay for it if you don't have any money, right? Did I miss something about the question?
So that would not be applicable if the person.
Is it 5 o'clock already?
Almost.
What time is it?
What?
5-2.
Okay.
Fine. Are we saying that would not be applicable if the husband is a poor man?
It's not that it's not applicable. It's like any debt. If you don't have the money, then you can't pay it. So what's the question?
So there's no question.
Right.
Right. I think.
If he has no money, what is he going to do? He dies. Now he has no money. Now what?
Sell his
boat. What can he possibly do?
His name is Yarshim O.
Well,
it's Yarshim O. It's a good
his point. Estate. Do they have to? They I don't know if they have to. I don't think they have to personally pay for it. They would have to pay for it from whatever they inherit from him. But if he doesn't have anything, he doesn't have anything. Okay. Number nine is that he obligates himself to pay for her daughters. That if in case that he gets divorced or he dies, so then he still has to pay for her daughters to be sustained until they get married. Her unmarried daughters. Number 10 is that...
Does that mean through another marriage?
No. It could be.
I don't think that makes sense.
Yeah, because it's his own daughters also.
Yeah, but they're not, what if they don't have daughters? I know people who have...
No, fine.
Five daughters, five boys.
Yeah, fine.
I know a lady that have five boys, six boys. Never had a daughter.
Yeah. And number 10 is that...
Sister has five daughters.
Part of the ksuba is that let's say he dies, right? Let's say she dies first and then he dies, right? And let's say he has children from multiple marriages, right? So it says that her children will first get, as part of their inheritance, whatever ksuba money is owed to the mother, would have been owed to the mother if she would have outlived him. And then you split the rest of the money in the regular laws of Yerusha, the regular laws of inheritance.
The same question we've had starting family. Amanda has many wives.
Yeah, exactly. So these are the 10 things that man obligates himself when he signs the ksuba. Then there's 4 things that the woman obligates herself when she signs the ksuba. And then there's Maise Yadeha, that she's going to give whatever income she gets from working, she gives to him.
Right.
Mitziyasa, whatever objects she finds that according to Allah she's allowed to keep, they automatically go to her husband. Number 3 is there's certain types of property that she brings into the marriage that she retains ownership of, but he is allowed to use the fruits of those properties. So the classical case, right, it's called Nichse Muluk. The classical case is that she brings a tree into the marriage, right? So she owns the tree, and if they get divorced or he dies, so she gets the tree instead of his inheritors getting the tree. But he's allowed to use the fruits of the tree as long as they're married.
Yeah, right? But I mean,
unless of course... I heard that if she waives her right to be supported, that he can't use the.
No, if she waives the right to be supported, then her income doesn't go to him. The first thing that we said, the Maisa Yadayim.
Right,
so we said Maisa Yadayim, which is her income. Mitzia is things that she found that she's allowed to keep. The third thing is this Nichse Milug, the fruits of property that she brings to the marriage.
And the fourth
thing is the halacha that if she dies before him, so then he inherits everything that she has.
Question,
instead
Rabbi.
Of her instead of her children, let's
question,
say.
Question, Rabbi. When,
yes, sir.
Nowadays, when do you actually see that everything that the woman makes goes to the husband? Come on, that doesn't happen.
Well, the husband allows her to use it as.
Even you see the women in our generation are like men. You take my money, get out of here. How do I know? Because I know people.
Okay, so that's the topic of the ksuba. I don't think we're gonna have time to go through all the other topics that I wanted to talk about, but let's see what we can get through. There's Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. Right? Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom is the excommunication of Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was one of the first Ashkenazi Rabbanim. He lived in the 900s, in approximately a generation or two before Rashi.
Wow.
And Rabbeinu Gershom made a decree. He made a few decrees. Some of his decrees are more famous than others. You know, he made a decree that you're not allowed to read somebody else's mail. That's called Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. He made another decree that you're not allowed to divorce a woman against her will. According to the Gemara, you're allowed to just give a get to a woman, give her a divorce bill, and she's divorced. But Rabbeinu Gershom made a decree that if you want to divorce a woman, you and her have to agree to the divorce. We hold this Rabbeinu Gershom till today.
What if she doesn't want to get divorced? You want to get divorced? So what do you mean?
So then, so you have to work it out until she wants to.
Offer her more money.
right? And wait, this gets even more difficult.
Interesting.
According to halacha, a man is allowed to have more than one wife, according to straight halacha. Right? Rabbeinu Gershom came along and he said that no, a man is only allowed to have one wife. You're not allowed to take a second wife.
For how many years in history?
What if it's party?
Did he say that?
What? So according to some opinions, Rabbeinu Gershom only limited this decree to the millennium that he lived in. There is such an opinion. But it seems that even if that's true, even if Rabbeinu Gershom sort of expired, but we still hold of this as halacha, because that has been the established minhag. Okay? So the question is, why did Rabbeinu Gershom make this gzer, this cherem, this decree that you're not allowed to have more than one wife? So there's four reasons that are brought down in the halachic peskim. One reason is because he's doing it in order to solve a lot of infighting. People, men and women, get into fights. So the more women you have, the more fights you're going to get into. And so therefore, to make sure there isn't going to be so much fighting, you only have one wife. So you won't fight as much. Right? Some people add that because Rabbeinu Gershom said that you're not allowed to divorce your wife against her will, so now you're stuck with her. So there's going to be more of a room for fighting. There's going to be more of a reason for fighting, because you're going to be stuck. You won't be able to get rid of her against her will. And so he sort of said, we'll get rid of the additional fighting by limiting the amount of wives they can have to one.
What if she teets on you and she doesn't want to get divorced against her will?
That's a different halacha. That's a different kettle of fish, as they say. That's a different kettle of fish. If she cheats on you, it's a whole different halacha. If another reason they say, why did Rabbeinu Gershom say that you can't have more than one wife, is because most people cannot afford to have more than one wife. So he's just, it's simply a pragmatic thing. You can't afford it, so we're just telling you, don't do it, right? Another reason they say is because the goyim, the Christians in the time of Rabbeinu Gershom, and even nowadays, the Christians have this rule or a prohibition of bigamy, of having more than one wife, right? Even in the United States, there's a law against bigamy, right? People say that it's unconstitutional because it discriminates against Mormons, that according to their religion, they're allowed to have more than one wife, but the rule is, and most Christians historically have upheld this rule, that you're not allowed to have more than one wife, right? So Rabbeinu Gershom felt that if the Christians are not allowed to have more than one wife, so then it might cause some animosity between Christians and Jews if the Jews would have more than one wife and the Christians wouldn't. And he said it could come to pikuach nefesh. It could come to a sakana. It'll come to cases of danger, that the Christians might be jealous, or they might look at the Jews with askance or whatever. And therefore, he made a blanket decree and said a Jew is not allowed to have more than one wife. The fourth explanation to Rabbeinu Gershom's cherem is that that the Gemara says in the end of the third parak of Bava Basra, in Chazkas Sabbatim, the Gemara says that because of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, so the Jewish people are in a perpetual state of mourning. And the Gemara says that really, we should have made a rule, made a decree, that no one's allowed to get married, because we're in mourning, and how could you get married if you're in the middle of mourning?
There's no future for Jewish
people. The Gemara says that if we made a rule that no one could get married, then there will be no continuation of the Jewish people. No one will be able to get married. They won't have any descendants. There won't be any next generation. So the Gemara says, so because of that, we didn't make this decree. But we really should have. That's what the Gemara says.
Right. Answer the Mashiach will come faster then.
So some say that Rabbeinu Gershom took this a step further. He said, fine. The Gemara said that because we're forced to, we're not going to make a decree that will outlaw marriage, because even though we're in mourning for the Beis HaMikdash. But he says, but at least we could limit marriage. So say, instead of having more than one wife, say only one wife, because that's what's necessary. More than one wife is already luxury, maybe they would say. It's not a necessity, it's a luxury. That's Cherem de Rabbeinu Gershom. We have time for, I think, one more topic. What do you guys want to know about? Yibum or Nida?
Nida.
Well, I know all about Nida.
Okay.
No, yes, I'm saying we don't. Yo, does Yibum?
Nida.
Nida, yeah, please.
Nida. All right, fine.
Yibum doesn't apply anymore.
Yeah.
What?
Yibum doesn't apply anymore. Yeah. Yeah.
Fine. So. So Nida, we'll go through a very basic crash, two sentence crash course of what is the halacha of Nida. We look. If you remember, look at the chart. that we gave out 2 days ago, or 3 days ago, was already. So on the chart we said that one of the sexual unions which incurs the punishment of kares is living with a menstruating woman. So what's the prohibition of nida? Is that you're not allowed to have intimate relations with a menstruating woman, right? Even anal relations is an iser kares.
What? Anal relations?
Yeah, anal. Even that's an iser kares. There's other things that are...
During nida or ever?
What?
During nida.
During nida, when she's in nida, right? When she's in nida. It means from when she starts her period, so she starts bleeding, and then the halacha is that you have to wait 4 days if you're Sephardi, 5 days if you're Ashkenazi, and then you can start, she sort of checks herself and makes sure that she stopped bleeding, and then she can count 7 clean days in which she checks herself every day and makes sure that she's not bleeding. So she has 7 clean days where she checks herself, and then she can go to the mikvah.
But if she never goes to the mikvah, then she's always...
If she never goes to the mikvah, she'll be nida for the rest of her life.
Oh,
that is correct.
Wow. Right? So what, 7 plus 5?
First 5. Anyways, she's going to be bleeding for usually 5-6 days. You know, from that, that's just natural. So 5 days or 4 days if you're Sephardi, and then 7 clean days, and then she can go to the mikvah, right? And then she goes to the mikvah and she comes back and she's already not a nida, and you can have relations with her again, right? That's the basic halacha of nida. There's something called vestas, which is when we expect that she might become a nida, right? There's a whole complicated topic about this. Vestas. That's like a vest, you know, like a fancy vest when you go. Like if you're a waiter at a fancy restaurant.
Isn't it called vestet?
Coat waist, yeah. It's called a coat waist. Vestet, yeah.
Isn't it called vestet?
Yeah.
Vestas is plural.
Vestas is plural, right? So the Gemara has all the halacha has all these complicated calculations. With, you know, when would you expect her to become anida? When do you expect her to menstruate? And then you're sort of obligated to separate from her at those times as well. That's vestas. There's a concept called harchakas, which means that you're supposed to distance yourself from your wife. See, because normally when there's a woman that you're not allowed to, that you're not allowed to marry, right? Your wife's sister. Right? So your wife's sister, you separate yourself from. You're not allowed to do yichud with her for sure. Right? You're not allowed to seclude yourself with her, but you're also not going to engage in physical contact with her. Right? You don't shake her hand. You don't hug her. You don't kiss her. You don't do that stuff. Right? So that all of that, of course, applies to anida, just like it applies to any woman that you're not allowed to marry.
Except for yichud.
But what?
Except for yichud.
Well, yichud you're allowed to do with a woman who's anida, unless you're newly married and you haven't consummated your marriage yet. But in general, you're allowed to do yichud with anida. But with anida, on top of the regular restrictions that you're not allowed to do with a woman that you're not allowed to marry, there's extra what's called harchakas, things to distance yourself from her. Because she's somebody that you do normally have relations with during the rest of the month, so you have a certain closeness with her, so therefore you have to do things to extra get away from her, right? So that means that you're not allowed to, let's say, pass items from one person to the other. You're not allowed to lift something together. You're not allowed to eat you're not allowed to eat her leftovers. Right? You're not allowed to eat an intimate meal together. You're not allowed to, you're not allowed to sit on the same bench together or the same couch together if by moving you can feel each other. All these different halachas to distance yourself, right? If you're going out on a date with a girl that you're thinking of marrying and you didn't marry her yet, so you're actually allowed to sit on the same couch as her. Right? There's no halacha that bars you from sitting on the same couch as her. But if she's your wife and she's a nida, you're not allowed to.
Interesting.
Well, the lady that you're dating, you hope that she's a nida, right? Because if she's not, then that means that she either went to the mikvah, which is somewhat sketchy, or it means that she hasn't had her period yet, which means that she's probably infertile, which is also not so good, right? So you hope that she's anida, but right, but you're allowed to sit on the same couch as with her. But if she's your wife and she's anida, you're not allowed to sit on the same couch as her. That is, in a nutshell, the halachas of nida. What time is it?
5:11.
Should we do another 5-10 minutes?
I don't mind.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess it looks like in the end we do have time to do the mitzvah of yibum. The mitzvah of Yibum is brought in the book of Deuteronomy. It says that if you have two brothers who are alive at the same time, and they're at least paternal brothers, meaning they at least share a father, could be they also share a mother, but they at least have to share a father, and one brother dies without having children, and but he was married. So the other brother is obligated to marry this brother's widow in order to establish a family for his deceased childless brother. Yeah? Normally, if you look back at our chart, so one of the forbidden relations, which incurs a punishment of kares, is marrying your brother's wife. Right? You're not allowed to marry your brother's wife. Your brother marries a woman, so you are banned from having sex with her, even if he divorces her, even if he dies, right? Unless it's your at least paternal brother's wife who dies without children. If he dies without children, so then you're allowed to marry her in order to establish a family under his name. And not only are you allowed to marry her, it's a mitzvah to marry her. You're obligated to marry her. The way it's looked at, it's as if the marriage of your brother sort of transfers to you, right? So what is the mitzvah of Yibum? The mitzvah of Yibum is to do sex with her, to have sex with her, and that creates a marriage between you and her. We spoke about way back when in the second shir, we spoke about how do you do kedushin. So one of the three ways of doing kedushin is there's sex, there's monetary, giving her something that has monetary value, and there's giving her a document, right? So doing yibum is the same thing as doing sex that creates the marriage. But we mentioned there, we said the halachas of kedushin, so we said that the rabbi said that you should not make kedushin through sex, you should do kedushin only through a document or through giving something of a monetary value. Therefore, the rabbi said that when you do yibum, you don't start off with sex, that's considered uncouth. Rather, you start with doing what's called a mimer, which is essentially a derabanan, a rabbinic version of doing kiddushin. You give her something of value, and then you have sex, and that's the mitzvah of yibum, according to the rabbanan. Now, if you don't want to do yibum, so then she's still halakhically obligated to marry you, and she's not allowed to marry anybody else in the interim. If you don't do yibum, you have the alternate, which is called chalitza.
Which has two brothers, which one does it go to?
It goes to the oldest one. What?
If he refuses, then it goes to the young one.
So what? If he refuses to, so it's a machlekes in the Gemara. If yibum is considered more preferable to chalitza, or it's not considered more preferable to chalitza, right? So if yibum is considered more preferable to chalitza, so you go to each brother in descending order, starting with the oldest to the next to each one. Where if anyone wants to do yibum, you do yibum. If none of them want to do yibum, then the oldest one does chalitza. That's basically the halacha in the Gemara.
So the oldest one doesn't need to do chalitza for the next one month.
Right.
So they get married.
So only one of the brothers has to do anything. What?
They're married for good.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So chalitza. What is chalitza? So if you look in the verses in Deuteronomy, what chapter is it? I think it's in 23, maybe 23 or 24 actually. It says, one second. So it's so. Yeah, it's in 25, Deuteronomy 25. So it's a whole ceremony where she takes off his shoe and she's sort of saying that, like, I could have been your wife and you rejected me, and she spits towards him, and it has to be done in front of a bezin, and then she's allowed to get married to somebody else. That's halacha of yibum and chalitza in a nutshell. Do we do yibum nowadays? So the halacha is that we don't do yibum nowadays. One reason is because we are choshesh, we suspect that the halacha is in accordance with the opinion that it's preferable to do chalitza than to do yibum. So that's one reason. And the other reason is that the halacha of yibum only applies if your brother died without children. But if he died and he had children, so then you're not allowed to do. Not only is yibum not a mitzvah, but it's a prohibition because it's marrying your brother's wife, right? So nowadays we say that nowadays people are a little bit more promiscuous than they had been in previous generations, and therefore maybe you think your brother died without children, but maybe he actually does have a child. You just know, just nobody else, nobody knows about it. And so therefore you're not supposed to do yibum. It's considered a problematic, and therefore we only do chalitza. And even chalitza is considered a rare occurrence, right? All these different things would have to line up. It's not so common that chalitza actually happens. That's actually an interesting question nowadays, because like whenever there's a chalitza, so like they have a whole, you know, the rabbis, the court make a whole thing and they make a whole ceremony, whatever, and people are like they feel that like they should have their own privacy and they want to do chalitza in a private setting, but a lot of people want to watch because it's like something interesting that doesn't happen so often. It's like every time there's like a chalitza in the news, like that's like the issue that the newspapers talk about. Like they didn't let these people do their chalitza in privacy. Okay, that's because I read Haaretz too much, but I shouldn't be reading these leftist newspapers.
What?
Yeah, there's different halachas that regarding the shoe. I don't want to get into all the halachas about the shoe. What I do want to get into is because this sort of wraps up what we were talking about in the last few days.
When I was in fifth grade, a rabbi came in with a chalitza shoe.
Yeah.
It was like, it had like wrappings and...
Yeah, it's a really cool thing.
Spit on it?
No, you don't spit. You spit towards it. You spit towards the guy. Just one last idea. This is actually the first mission, the first topic in the tractate of Yevamos. This sort of wraps up what we were discussing the last few days. What would happen if, right? We spoke about, should you marry your niece, right? So let's say a guy marries his niece, right? My brother marries my daughter, right? So and then let's say I die, right? So a guy, you have a guy. And his daughter, and the brother marries the daughter, right? So the guy, and then the guy dies, right? So now, Yibum would say that he should have a mitzvah to marry his own daughter, right? Because his brother died childless, so you have to marry his widow. But his widow happens to be his daughter, this guy's daughter, right? So are you allowed to marry your own daughter in order to do the mitzvah of Yibum? What do you guys say?
No.
What do you say?
Well. If you think about it with the answer with your gut, you would say no. But if you think about it with your head, since it's also usher to marry your brother's sister, what's a brother's wife? What's the difference in the Torah? So then it would be the same. So you would marry your daughter.
No. So the first Mishnah in Maseches Yevamos says that there's 15 women that if your brother married them. And he died. You're not obligated to do either yibum or chalitza because these are women that are so forbidden to you that it incurs a punishment of kares. You're not allowed to marry them. You're not allowed to do yibum to them. It's forbidden to do yibum. It's a punishment of kares, right? It could be. It's even another punishment of besides the fact that she's your daughter, she's also your brother's wife because there's no mitzvah of yibum. So there's like two kares prohibitions in this case, right?
I think that's a pretty extreme example. It's not going to happen in the next day or two.
That's true. Could be.
Just something to think about.
I'm just saying. Like
let's say your brother marries. Let's say you have two brothers. Yeah. Their father was a Kohen. Okay. One brother was the son of a divorcee, and one brother was the son of a woman that a Kohen is allowed to marry. Right. So one brother is not a Kohen. He's a Cholol, and the other brother is a Kohen. Right. And let's say this guy who's a halal, he goes ahead and he marries a lady who a halal is allowed to marry. He marries a divorcee, right? And then he dies. Right? And now he comes to the brother who's a Kohen to do yibum, right? Marry your brother's widow, but she's a divorcee. How can I marry her? Do you marry her or not? And this falls into the category of women that you're not allowed to marry because of a positive and a negative prohibition. Positive and negative commandment. Do you do yibum or do you not do yibum? So there the Gemara says, the halacha is, you do not do yibum, you are obligated to do chalitza.
Okay.
The Gemara says that the midaraisa, according to the Torah, you're obligated to do chalitza. Fine. Let's say your brother marries a mamzer. Right? A mamzeres, a female mamzer. Right? And then he dies, and it comes to you to do yibum to this lady who is a mamzeres, a female mamzer. Right? So do you have to, can you do yibum or can you not do yibum? This case is only a case of a negative prohibition to marry her. Are you allowed to do yibum or chalitza? What's the halacha? So the Gemara says that really, according to the letter of the law, midaraisa, according to the Torah law, you're allowed to do yibum with her. Because we have a rule that a positive commandment supersedes a negative commandment. Essay doicha loisa say a positive commandment when the Torah says asay do doicha it pushes away loisa say it pushes away when the Torah says do not do.
But if they would have
do pushes away do not do.
Well,
seder
That's not the question. You're right, fine, you're right, but that's not the question.
That's why you're allowed to do
Malacha. So the Gemara says that to the letter of the law, you're allowed to do Yibam to her. Because but the Gemara adds a caveat that in this case, the essay, the mitzvah, is only the first act of intimacy that you have with her. That's where the mitzvah comes. That first act. The problem is that after the first act, even though you'll be stuck, because you'll be married to her, because doing the act of Yibam is like doing Kedushin, but you won't be allowed to have relations with her anymore. Right? So the Gemara says, because of this conundrum, that even though the first act of intimacy would be technically permitted, but subsequent acts of intimacy would be prohibited, so the rabbis made a decree that you're not allowed to do Yibam to her. At all. But it's only rabbinic in origin. And therefore, since it's rabbinic in origin, right, she's sort of stuck, because according to the Torah law, she has to do either Yibam or Chalitza. So the rabbis say, okay, so you have to do Chalitza. So here you're doing Chalitza because the rabbis are forcing you to do Chalitza in this case.
We do Yibam, you're allowed to be together once?
All right, thank you for coming. What? No, that's not true. When you do Yibam, you're allowed to be together forever. But the mitzvah is only the first time. What Yibam is that it creates a marriage.
Okay. And also, before Matan Torah, father-in-law is allowed to do Yibam.
That's true, yeah. The Ramban says that about Yehuda and Tamar. That's correct.
Very, very
all right, thank you for coming and thank you for staying.